Hello, misfits, outliers, nonconformists, and boundary pushers. Welcome to our show. I am Brooke Warner, joined as I am every week by my extremely right-minded co-host, Grant Faulkner. And today we're talking about the edges of things, about precipices and outer limits and frontiers. One of the things that comes with this territory, I think, is overcoming fears on the one hand. Writers who dare to explore these spaces have to muster up their courage. And I would also say a unique kind of boldness, which is different from courage. It's more about power, really. When you're exploring the outer edges, you simultaneously come to your writing from a centered and knowing place. Like, yes, it might be scary. Yes, some people won't like what you have to say. Yes, you're being incredibly vulnerable on the page, but it's also all worth it because maybe you've been living too many years playing it safe or conforming or doing what you were told. And now in your writing, you're coming out in a sense as the complex and deep thinking person you are, you know, as someone who's ready to be heard. So these are the people we're celebrating today. And who I personally think have a wonderful representative in Lydia Yuknovich, who is today's guest. So Grant, I'd love to have your take on this idea of walking the outer limits, because I think you do in your fiction. You do it in being a boundary breaker with your flash fiction, and you've talked about the discrepancy people sometimes experience between your nice guy persona and your oftentimes dark fiction. So does this idea of writing on the margins resonate with you?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's really the reason we're in this endeavor of writing. In the end, we write and read to explore and understand humanity, ourselves, and the world on the most, you know, fundamental and extreme way. And the only way we can do that is to really go to those dangerous limits. I always say that the best writing is the writing that is the most vulnerable and risky. A writer's honesty and truth-telling transcends any writing techniques of rules or craft. It's its own special talent, really. And honestly, I'd rather read a piece of writing that is messy but honest than a piece that is perfectly polished and correct but doesn't dare tell a deep truth or go out to those margins. It's tough, though. Because in risking embarrassment, we're going to feel embarrassed. And sometimes, it's likely to make us feel shame. Someone's likely to make us feel shame. And I think what's important to keep in mind is that if you have an unspoken truth, then others have that truth. So it's likely to resonate on some level with others. And also, we all have dark sides as human beings. We're imperfect creatures who sometimes do horrible things. And it's only through our stories that we can better understand ourselves and that dark side itself. And dark isn't exactly the right word. It's just a side of ourselves that goes outside of the usual conventional boundaries sometimes as well.
So true. I work with a lot of authors who want to write on that radical edge, I'm going to call it, which is David White's term, the poet David White, who I love, but they're scared. They're scared to go out to that edge, or they don't have access to those depths within themselves. And the radical edge is, to me, that point of growth in life, certainly, but definitely in writing, where you know you're pushing yourself because you feel both terrified and exhilarated at the same time. And so you're going where everyone has told you you should not go. And it's a place of upending the status quo, oftentimes of great personal consequence, because the radical edge is often where you rise to a challenge and where you take a giant leap and then look around and realize, nope, you did not die. You totally survived. And David White's poem that speaks to this is called Start Close In. And I know a lot of writers are familiar with this poem, so I'm just going to read its opening lines here. But he writes, "Start close in. Don't take the second step or the third. Start with the first thing. Close in. The step you don't want to take." I adore this poem because it's a poem that seems to have been written for writers, maybe particularly memoirists. The step you don't want to take, and yet you must. And you do it because you have to start someplace and you have to be true to yourself. And you want to also step into the greatness of yourself. And so when I think about radical edges, I think about the risk that it is to write in the first place. And we talk about that on the show a lot, Grant. We acknowledge it. But there are so many risks writers take. So I'd love to ask you, what are some things about writing or just, you know, over the course of your life that have felt risky or that have truly been risks? And how have those risks paid off, or have they?
Yeah, I love that phrase, radical edge, to start. And I love the David White poem as well. And really, every part of the writing life is a risk. I remember how initially telling others I wanted to be a writer was a risk because people immediately judged me on a whole bunch of levels in a way they wouldn't have if I'd said I wanted to be a doctor or a lawyer. And then, as I said, writing a true story is a risk by definition, and that's easier said than done, writing a true story. You really have to think about, what is a true story? How do you tell that truth? And then sharing that story amplifies the risk. You know, you're essentially bearing yourself to another, offering up your most tender and fragile parts. And whether you do this with a best friend by sharing a story or by publishing a book or reading in public, which is its own sort of really, you know, risky act, everything's a risk along the way. Someone is likely to have a reaction that might hurt you, that you're always in danger of that. You know, it's a strange paradox. I think the urge to write is often an urge to be loved and to be understood. But the paradox is that it often doesn't serve that purpose sometimes. And that's the risk. That's the feeling that can prevent you from taking that. I guess he says it's not a first step, but the first step, the first movement in the David White poem. I think we let our fears decide too much in life, and that taking that first step in writing is not only important, but by taking that first step in writing, you're likely to be taking it in other realms of your life as well. So it's a lifelong exercise in not being afraid to be yourself, in other words.
Totally. And I think the reason that this whole conversation resonates so deeply with me is because we're talking about writing, but of course, this is about our lives. And I think about the huge life risk I took when I fell in love with my ex-wife. I mean, obviously, falling in love is a thing that happens to you, but it was out there on the radical edge for me, figuring out for myself that this was something I was going to pursue, this thing that would alter my identity, and that felt like it came with all kinds of unknowns and potential repercussions. But I had to take the next step because there were no other options that I could see. I wasn't willing to say, I don't want this. I, in fact, wanted it more than anything. And I think a lot of people can relate to this kind of thing whenever you find yourself on a path that's against the grain, but it's clear what your next step is going to be. So I'm thinking about so many memoirists I've worked with, like Linda Curtis, who wrote a She Writes Press memoir called Shunned, about her experience of leaving the Jehovah's Witness faith and the great personal consequence and loss of her family that resulted from that. And I'm thinking about Jenny Block, who's one of my authors at Seal Press, who, you know, now more than 15 years ago wrote a book called Open, about her open relationship and the incredible risk that that was to expose her relationship in that way. And I'm thinking about many countless people who are persecuted for their religious beliefs, or the children and grandchildren of those people who carry it with them like a legacy. And I've worked with many memoirists who are unpacking the stories of their parents and grandparents who fled or survived Nazi Germany and the Holocaust. And so memoirists who are writing in this vein often land at a place where they're compelled to say, like, look, this is who I am. This is what I've been through. This is what I've survived. And I think these sentiments drive, you know, 90% plus of all memoirists. And I'm pretty sure they probably drive a lot of fiction too.
Yeah, absolutely. We all have a truth or truths to tell. And we have this incredible human need to not only understand, but to be understood. And I think this often goes unspoken, that our central frustration in life is not being properly understood, whether it's by a friend, a parent, a partner, or a work colleague. You know, writing helps us articulate all of those layers that make up our worlds. And it seems to give us a better shot at being understood. You know, sometimes that's not the case, but it at least seems that way. And we're in pursuit of being understood. And at worst, I think it helps us understand ourselves more. And that's what is the most important thing in the end.
Yeah. And for these reasons and more, I'm so thrilled to have Lydia Yuknovich on today's show. I was supposed to interview her at the Bay Area Book Festival, which, along with basically every other literary event in the country, was canceled this year. So I'm feeling very grateful for these online connections we can have as we hold so many unknowns. And this is fitting for today's theme, too, because standing in the unknown is its own kind of edge. And Lydia's newest book is called Verge, a book of short stories where the characters are all misfits and rejects and outsiders grappling with their own experiences of alienation in the world. And right now we're collectively dealing with alienation too. We are also displaced. We are grappling with a kind of suspended reality. And I know it's affecting people's writing. and in potentially positive ways. So that should be said. And I actually hope that people who are feeling drawn to write can encourage themselves to lean into the unknown and to see what might come out of their writing as a result. Because my sense is that there's a real deep collective energetic force that's pulsing right now, you know, that's a byproduct of all of us having this unprecedented collective experience. And there's an opportunity to tap into that writing. And so I'd love to hear from listeners to tell us if you've been feeling that or doing that. Have you, Grant?
Yeah, you know, this is such a unique moment. We've never had a collective experience like this in my lifetime. And we're certainly feeling a shared vulnerability that is actively changing who we are individually and in relation to others. And we're all reacting to the need, the desire, the capability to write in a lot of different ways. And in a lot, you know, that can change in the course of a day or an hour. And I like to think of the great Leonard Cohen lyrics from his song Anthem. He says, "Ring the bells that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in." And I find it such a hopeful message when there are those cracks in life. And this is a time of cracks, but the cracks also invite in the light. And the light has a different quality, different layers to it, a different kind of illumination. And I think that can inspire creativity. We're living with different images and different metaphors now. We're distanced yet closer in different ways. We might touch each other less, but connect more. And all that feeds into ringing the bells that can still ring, you know, into our writing and in other words.
Thank you so much for that, Grant. And let's continue to invite in the light as we move on to today's interview with Lydia Yuknovich, which will happen right after this short interlude.
You know, Brooke, with all that's going on in the world right now, the Great Courses Plus is particularly valuable. We're spending more time than ever at home, obviously, and lots of us who have kids at home are trying to find interesting and educational things for them to watch. So, in fact, the Great Courses Plus has been a little bit of a lifesaver, at least in our household, these past few weeks.
Yes, that's so true. And it's for kids of all ages. So my guy who's 9 and your kids who are in high school. And one of the things I've loved about it is exploring the great outdoors while staying in my very confined indoors, since I'm getting to experience a little bit of armchair travel. And that's especially good for those of us who derive a lot of happiness from being out in the world. Certainly true for me. And the Great Courses Plus is helping me with these long days and weeks by giving me content to look at. And I am so grateful. Grant, is there a course that you've checked out since we last talked?
Yeah, I happen to be still taking the course on learning how to play the guitar, and I'll probably just keep repeating that course for a good while. But then since my daughter, she actually wants to become the first doctor in the history of our family on any side, I think the first science-related occupation of any sort. And so we're taking a guide to infectious diseases together. So it's odd to say, but a virus has led to father-daughter bonding and learning.
That's great. And one of the things that I love about the Great Courses Plus is how nimble and responsive they are. They add courses that are meaningful to what we're going through today. I watched the course called What is Coronavirus? And there have been a number of new classes with historical relevance. And I, again, super grateful that they're doing that. I don't have a scholarly dog like Buster to enjoy these with. And James will not tolerate the virus or the history classes. But my dog, Bee, is a people pleaser. So she lets me watch whatever I want. And so we are streaming from the TV now, and that makes her happy because we can enjoy these classes from the comfort of our own couch.
Sounds fun. We have a new special offer from the Great Courses Plus this week, and it's a free trial of unlimited access to the entire library. I want to emphasize the words free and unlimited and library. So you can sign up today using our special URL to get started. And Brooke, can you provide our special URL?
That's right. We have a special URL that was created to be used. So please use it. It is thegreatcoursesplus.com/rightminded.
You have to say it twice now because it's in the script.
Right. Thank you. I love saying it twice. Remember, thegreatcoursesplus.com/rightminded. Welcome back, everybody. We are here with Lydia Yuknovich, and Lydia is the author of the widely acclaimed memoir, The Chronology of Water, and the national best-selling novels, The Book of Joan and The Small Backs of Children, the novel Dora, A Head Case, and a critical book on war and narrative, Allegories of Violence. She's known for her TED Talk, The Beauty of Being a Misfit, which has been viewed well over 2.5 million times, in her follow-up book, The Misfits Manifesto, and her newest book, Verge, just came out in February. She founded the workshop series Corporeal Writing in Portland, Oregon, where she teaches both in person and online, and she received her doctorate in literature from the University of Oregon. She lives in Oregon with her husband, Andy Mingo, and their Renaissance man son, Miles. She is also a very good swimmer. Lydia, I'm so grateful to have you here with us today. Thank you.
I'm grateful to be with anyone, anywhere, in any form right now.
It really is that kind of thing going on. Yes. So, well, let's start with Verge, which is mesmerizing and spellbinding and weird and disturbing and wonderful. I think your work has this effect on people, actually, of pressing on so many emotional levers that you're really not sure how to feel. And the characters who populate Verge, which is a collection of short stories, are all, as the title suggests, at the edges, the fringes, the margins. So let's start with them. What is your relationship like with the characters in a collection of short stories, as opposed to the relationship that you might have with characters in a novel or the real life characters in your memoir?
Oh, what a great question. I guess the scariest answer is they probably all live inside my body. And so imagine trying to walk around in the world with that inside you. Mm. Really interesting circus or wrestling match. But more specifically, this book of short stories, all the stories in Verge are actually little love letters to people I either literally know in my life or people I've moved very close to in life and understood as kindred. And so that's a little piece of the making of the book that, you know, you wouldn't know that unless I told you. So I'm telling you. The difference with the characters in the most recent novels I've written have to do with my addiction to history and art and sexuality. And so the characters emerge out of those idea realms or concept realms, and then they become people, and then they just live in my house with me and my family for however long it takes me to finish a novel. And then, of course, in memoir or nonfiction, there's you, there's only you, and you can't get away from you. It's, you know, the big writing question is, how can I write into the center of self and break it apart so that the ego isn't the most important thing, and the sediments of self that could reach out toward other humans and not just the ego of the individual. I feel as if that's the goal of the best memoir writing.
Hmm, interesting. You know, Lydia, I read an interview you gave to the Paris Review in which you talked about how for you, the form always comes first and then the story follows. And you also said, and I'm summarizing here, that you had a real breakthrough when you discovered that a story could be a sequence of emotional intensities rather than necessarily needing to follow a traditional story arc. I particularly love this because this is how I write. But I've often felt that, no, I need to be following a story arc because that's what we're taught, I guess.
Yes.
And so I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how that revelation informs your work.
Oh, absolutely. I love talking about this. So thank you. I'm glad you write that way. We need more of you.
Exactly.
Well, the first place I ran across the concept was in this slim volume of a book called Tropisms.
Yeah. Natalie Serreau.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, one of my favorites.
Go. I'm so happy. I'm like jumping up and down right now, except for
me too.
So, that book blew my mind. I walked around for a whole year just like, this is the thing. This is it. And what I understood most profoundly from that idea is that traditional linear plot only lets you tell certain kinds of stories and not others. And traditional linear plot also only lets certain bodies and experiences alive in the room. And it didn't relate to my body or my experience or any of the bodies or experiences or stories of the people I loved the most. People on the margins of the socius or even on the margins of identity. And so, you know, you and I aren't the first people to realize there should be more than one way to tell a story. But that idea in particular, that life and bodies and stories happen in micro movements or micro intensities or even emotional micro intensities, just so resonated with me. Like my whole body vibrated like a tuning fork. And then I thought of writers who I thought accomplished that. And in their different ways, I mean, Emily Dickinson and Virginia Woolf and Gertrude Stein treated the realm of language as if you could do that inside language. I suddenly had a whole mother load of literary foremothers for me anyway. And I just abandoned the linear narrative from that day forward. I just decided, well, everybody else can tell those kinds of stories. And I'm going to probably the rest of my life, and I think this is true, I'm still working on this, try to arrange pieces in a way that reflects my actual body and my actual experiences. And if that moves away from traditional plot, so be it.
Well, and I think you've been successful at it, and it shows. I mean, your readership will just follow you wherever you go. And I did see a funny Goodreads review about The Chronology of Water. It made me laugh because it said, Lydia Yuknovich is not afraid to overshare. and you most certainly are not. And I think that's essential for good memoir. It's essential for a meaningful TED Talk. And you're also all the way out there in social media, not holding anything back. And when I see your stuff, I always just feel like yelling, hell yeah, because you write a lot about injustices and wrongs. So the question I have is whether there's ever a cost to this for you as a writer. And do you think that in today's climate, where people's most loyal following is often on social media, that writers and authors do well to be out there in that way, you know, to live out loud?
Oh, that's so tough because I also know that you're aware that I'm pretty open about the darker sides of experience, like depression and addiction and suicidal ideation and homelessness and stuff like that, and anger, rage, you know, untempered rage. And so it's such a tricky thing. I think I've said this a lot, so sorry if it's boring, but social media is like a giant fucking cesspool. So there's that, right? And partly it's that because suddenly we have a way to put the id on the outside of our psyches and blast it and turn the volume up and spread it all over everyone. And it's like we can't help it. We're in such a nascent developmental stage with social media that we're just like spooging everywhere. We can't stop ourselves. And so that makes us cesspool. And it's horrible. On the other hand, like everything else in life, the other side of its brutality is its beauty. And the possibility space opened up for phenomenon like the Me Too movement or the Black Lives Matter movement. Social media created a speed with which, you know, critical mass could form and a way to undercut the lie visually and wide, massive community networkings in a way that we'd never seen before, or it was never as possible. Even the Arab Spring moment, I think, participated in, you know, this rhizomic possibility space that social media is available for. But if you're asking me about authors and being an author, a writer, and living a writerly life, and this idiotic mythology, so now you can tell where my bias is, that one must have a social media presence and platform. I find that both true in terms of we're told it's true, and I find it repugnant enough that I resist it even as I'm participating in it. I mean, a thing we forget as art people is that we produce the content And the idea that you must perform a presence on social media and in terms of platforms. Again, I'm a realist. So yeah, that's true. And I hate it with all of my guts because it's participating in a capitalist trick situation that takes your content away from you. And I don't want to be an artist if the equation is my content gets taken away from me. I'd like my content to belong to my actual body. And so, you know, you don't really have a choice about whether you participate or not. But while you're participating, you also have the possibility to resist and agitate. That'd be what I'd say.
Well, Lydia, you're known for writing about the body and about sex and sexuality and for writing about people who don't fit in, outliers and in-between spaces. I'm curious if you could talk about what draws you to a blank page. What is the experience in your own body of knowing you have a story that wants or needs to come out?
Form. So that goes back to that form question. When I see a blank page or a blank piece of drawing paper or a blank canvas, or I guess a screen or a stage, they're all similar to me. I see like the openness of the sky or ocean or, you know, some fluid giant space. And the idea that form could emerge inside that space is just endlessly fascinating to me. I'm going to be obsessed with it the rest of my life. The second you walk up to a piece of drawing paper and let, like, if you hold a pen or a crayon or a pastel or pencil in your hand and you make your wrist kind of fluid and you just let a line emerge and then you let that line sit there for a minute and you just stare at it until it starts to look like something. Does anybody know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's what writing is for me too. I'll put a line or two. When I say a line or two, I mean, you know, a sentence or a phrase or two. And it's the same thing. It's like expression trying to come to form, to find form. And that's what I meant in that other interview when I said the form comes first. I'll chase that drawn line or that written few lines anywhere. I don't care where it goes, which is why I don't have to worry about the things other writers worry about. But eventually a character kind of needs to emerge and a story kind of needs to emerge. So I'm still radically responsible to what's on the page. I'm just responsible in a different way.
Well, Lydia, last year you presented at my Magic of Memoir event and you went deeply into the fear factor and specifically how to demystify and transform fear into creative energy for writing and life. So what role has fear played in your creative process and what advice do you have for writers who are hindered by fear?
It's so tricky to talk about because on the one hand, fear has been everything for me because I am one of those people who from a very young age experienced terror just to be in the world or to speak or to enter rooms with other people in them. And I still have that. I still have a difficult time getting out of bed or leaving the house or moving in the world with other people. I can tell at this point in life, people don't see that about me anymore. I don't present it as that. I get that, but it remains true nonetheless. And so for me, fear has been everything. So I had to figure out if I was going to live or die by it. And when I chose life, it meant I had to turn fear into something besides the thing making me paralyzed. And what has worked for me is to endlessly try and imagine ways in which my fear could be a portal and not the end wall. And so every day in my life, every week, every month, every year changes, every few years, I have to reinvent what this portal business means. And I'll do it by any means necessary rather than letting my obsessions and anxieties and addictions like consume me.
That's a really good transition to the next question, because water is another really important current in your writing. And you're a lifelong swimmer. You've said that water has saved your life. And you wrote a gorgeous piece for LitHub called I Will Always Inhabit the Water. So first, I'm curious if during these days of shelter in place, are you finding water? And then second, perhaps you can share with our listeners what water and language have in common for you.
Well, I suppose you know the pools are closed.
Yeah.
So there's been some infiltration and sort of stealth excursions just so I can get in some water without the fuzz busting me. But in general, like everyone right now, I don't have access to my waters. I can't even go to the coast in the same way right now, which is for me quite excruciating. That's how I bring myself back to life. So you would not believe how much time I'm spending in the shower and the bathtub. Huh. What are you going to do, right? So there's that, literally. But for me, water and language are both metaphors and maybe allegories, too, of the subconscious. And water or the ocean, you know, I'm not the person who thought of that. Freud wrote extensively about it. Jung wrote extensively about it. But I really plugged into that idea, I got to be honest with you, since I've wanted to live in water my whole life. So the ocean is like this primordial reminder of where all life came from. And it's carrying all our memories and life and death and animals and destruction. And, you know, so that's why the ocean is like the subconscious. And when I say language is like the subconscious, I don't mean after we use it. I mean, before we use it, before it's ordered, before it even becomes sentences or phrases or stanzas or whatever, or even a single word, before its meaning, there's a pre-linguistic existence of language, and that's more fluid. And it could have gone in any order over time, but it didn't. It came to form in the orders we have received it, inherited it. And so if I can think backwards in terms of what language is before the orders got set, it reminds me of something more like space or the ocean, and I feel better. In fact, the novel I just finished is an attempt to, you know, track backwards inside myth-making and storytelling and language to a before where, you know, the meanings could have gone anywhere, and they didn't have to go towards, for instance, capitalism and power. They could have gone somewhere else, and that idea still interests me.
Well, in closing, I'd like to ask you about this time we're living in with coronavirus, and the world is turned upside down. Verge came out in early February, just 1 month, or pretty much practically when the pandemic escalated. And when we corresponded to set up for today's interview, you said that you were wobbly and weird, which perfectly captures every day for me. So I'm wondering what you might share about writing or book launching or anything else for that matter, you know, for other writers who might be feeling the same way we are.
Well, I've been watching over social media, since that's mostly how we can stay in touch with each other. I've been watching a lot of people talking about not being able to write or feeling too afraid or a lot of grief and mourning and so forth. And I completely sympathize. I empathize. I'm cycling through those things too every hour now instead of every few days. It's like we're cycling through all our emotions on speed over and over again. And so I don't have any magical wizardress advice or anything. I do know that if you are a writer or an artist, it was always in you to be that. And in times of struggle or duress, it's even more in you to be that. And so I would only say, yes, it's hard. And yes, it hurts, but not like the death of a loved one, or not like having to be a doctor or a nurse or anyone else who works in a hospital right now. And so maybe we could take turns or link arms. And, you know, today it's my day to tell the story, but I can't do it every day. So maybe tomorrow it could be your day. And in that way, maybe we could keep ourselves writing and making art instead of succumbing to the paralysis of despair. And it's just an idea. And I know it won't work for everyone, but it's what I have to give.
Thank you for that, Lydia.
Thanks so much for joining us today, Lydia.
You guys are great.
Hey, everyone. We'll be right back with this week's Takeaway with Brooke.
So today's takeaway is a little challenge that I'm going to offer you that I presented to my son's third grade class a couple of weeks ago when I stepped in to teach a poetry class of all things because our school district had put him on a temporary Zoom hiatus. So the kids found themselves without their teacher and therefore they had me for the day. And I had them write a poem from a prompt, which I'm going to share here, and which, because it might be hard for some of you to follow audibly, we're going to put it on the show episode notes as well, which you can find on our website, which is podcast.shewrites.com for those of you who want to do the poem. And you can do this with your kids because that's who it's for, actually. But I think it's really great for adults because it gets you out of your head and into your senses. It's prompting you to think about things that might be imaginary, and that can support you in the exploration of boundary breaking or boundarylessness. And so here's how the prompt goes. The first stanza is, I am, and you put in two special characteristics that you have. I wonder, insert something of curiosity. I hear, insert an imaginary sound. I see, insert an imaginary sight. I want, insert an actual desire. The second stanza goes, I pretend, insert something you pretend to do. I feel, insert a feeling about something imaginary. I touch, insert an imaginary touch. I worry, insert something that bothers you. I cry, insert something that makes you sad. And the final stanza, I understand, insert something that is true. I say, insert something you believe in. I dream, insert something you dream about. I try, insert something you make an effort about. I hope, insert something you hope for. And finally, I am, which you repeat the first line of the poem. So I hope some of you will try this. My son James did it, and I was pretty delighted with the outcome. Again, you can find those details on the site if you, you know, it's a little hard to, I realize, to follow them in this way. So we hope you will. We hope you'll share your experience, and thank you.
Love that, Brooke. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. I want you to remember several things. First, remember to wash your hands. Second, remember to stay 6 feet away from others, but stay close to right-minded. We're a weekly podcast, so we'll be back next week with a fabulous, inspiring guest. And you can download Right-Minded on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you can, please give us a little rating or write a little comment. We love them. And we will see you next week.